Welcome, members and guests, to our annual Melbourne Cup celebration. Today it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Andrew Lemon. His credentials have been circulated already, so I've just got a brief summary. He's had a long career as an independent professional historian, and I've known Andrew through my work and at the Parliamentary Library probably 20 years ago. He's published widely on topics ranging from schools, sport, shipwrecks, biography and local history. He's the recipient of many national literary awards. For his extensive body of work, the University of Melbourne awarded him the prestigious degree of Doctor of Letters in 2005. He's best known for his three-volume history of Australian thoroughbred racing. This is not the sort of book you'd read in the toilet. It's a serious, serious thesis, tome. He's also the consultant historian to the Victorian Racing Club. There's no one better qualified to speak to us on the history of the Cup and why it is important than Andrew Lemon. Thank you. Please make him welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, President Robert, and everybody for coming here. It's a real honour to be invited to speak to Melbourne Rotary. Your good works are famous, but I still think under-recognised in the community. Maybe that's the way you want it to be, but you're a good news story, and I'm really honoured to be part of it. And not the sort of book to be read in the toilet. I think we'll go on the next edition on the back cover. I hope that's a compliment, Bruce. But yes, it's three large volumes over, started way back in the 1980s, working with the then state artist Harold Friedman, who was commissioned to do a series of mural paintings about the history of racing at Flemington Racecourse, and that was the origin of that project. To our overseas guests, you must be a bit bemused about this extraordinary idea that Melbourne, and indeed most of Victoria, and large parts of Australia grind to a halt for a horse race on the first Tuesday of November. I think it can only be explained in terms that Rio has its Mardi Gras and France has its Bastille Day. America has the 4th of July, and with apologies to Australia Day, Melbourne Cup Day is in a sense a day when Australians feel that they are Australians. And interestingly enough, in the colonial period, there was a sense that the coming together of Australians around Melbourne Cup Day was called a precursor of federation. I've been doing a little bit of study for the VRC. I was asked to investigate the role of the governors and governor-generals coming to Melbourne Cups. And it's a pretty popular gig. On one occasion, we had no less than five governors and a governor-general all coming to Melbourne for that occasion. And of course, it was famous that the British fleet would always come into Melbourne in that particular time of year as well. So it's embedded in our Australian history. So I have written a lot about it, and a brief history of the Melbourne Cup in 20 minutes is a bit like doing the collected works of William Shakespeare in an evening. It's a very long history. And so if you think about the racing business and what gets the hype these days, well, we had the Everest in Sydney, which is now one and a bit years old. It's had two runnings. And we've got the Golden Slipper, a two-year-old race, a sprinting race in Sydney, first begun in the 1950s. We've got the Cox Plate, famously won by Winx for the fourth time on Saturday, started in the 1920s, in 1922. And then you've got the Melbourne Cup, which this year we're about to have the 158th consecutive running of that race. It's an extraordinary longevity, and it dates back to 1861 when the town of Melbourne was really only 25 years old. Flemington Racecourse itself was established within 5 years of European settlement here. People got their priorities right in those days. There'd already been a couple of race meetings down near basically Docklands, but Governor La Trobe, who wasn't really a racing man, but he understood the colonial passion, and he set aside the racecourse at Flemington, which in those days was called the Melbourne Racecourse, became known as Flemington. And that first Melbourne Cup in 1861 was run in November, and we've been running it ever since. We've never missed a year, extraordinarily. There are not very many races around the world that can claim that. There are, when I talk about the history of Melbourne Cup, I think there are two aspects. I wrote an article which is, this book here is a book to which I contributed, possibly out of print these days, but if you need a Bible to tell you about aspects of the history of the Melbourne Cup, then this book called The Story of the Melbourne Cup, Australia's Greatest Race, was a compilation of wisdom of a number of different racing writers, and I wrote a bit there about the origins of the sport, and I think it's it was done for the 2010, which was our 150th running of the Cup. And in that, I wrote an article which I think was called the Never-Ending Story, but what I really wrote on my first article was the never-changing, ever-changing Melbourne Cup, because there are some things which have never changed about the Melbourne Cup and which I think are part of the secret of its success, of its enduring success. So you think about it, it is extraordinary to think that it is still run in the spring, usually in the first week of November. There have been occasional oddities in that story, but basically it's a spring race. It's been run at Flemington every year. It's always been a two-mile race. I modified that with metrication in 1972 when it was slightly shortened to 3,200 metres to make a nice round number. Maybe those 18 metres make a difference in the photo finish. Sometimes I think it would. But basically, it's run at the same course, over the same distance. It is, and always has been, a handicap race, which distinguishes it, for better or for worse, from most of the other great races of the world. And that means that the best horses are told they have to carry a bit more weight than they would like to, and the horses who are trying to get in under can sometimes get away carrying less weight than they might be supposed to carry. There have been changes. The evolution is that handicap has shifted over the years, so the best horses are not asked to carry quite the grandstand that Carbine was asked to carry in 1890 when he won with, I think it was 10 stone 5, which is about 63 kilograms, if not 65. So the lighter weight horses, they used to be ridden by small boys because they were the only people to get down to the weight. I think the minimum now is likely to be 52 kilograms. So those things have changed, but it's still a handicap race. It's still, as it always did from 1861, attracts the best available horses. It was very cunning of the organisers of the Melbourne Cup to allow a Sydney horse to win the first two runnings of the race, and we've been allowing foreigners to win most of them ever since. Archer, you will have heard of, the horse who won the first two Melbourne Cups. But one of my jobs as historian is sometimes to spoil good stories. That's what historians are there to do. And so for those of you who don't accept this, it was often understood that Archer walked from New South Wales all the way down to Melbourne to win the Melbourne Cup and walked home again. Unfortunately, some years ago, we did the forensic homework and discovered that he came by ship. He went home by ship. He came back the next year by ship and went home again by ship. And we know the name of the ship, and it's there in the official records. Archer actually came down for a third crack at the Melbourne Cup. There was a bit of intercolonial politics, and he didn't get to start, probably just as well because he had even more weight than Carbine was supposed to carry. But even on that occasion, he came by ship. So when I tell those stories, there was a long period where I was not allowed in Nowra, which was the birthplace of Archer, where he was trained. But the local historian has come to the party and agreed it's all true that Archer came by ship. But I like to exchange that with other stories, and there are other horses who have famously done extraordinarily long walks to get to Flemington. I find that the history of racing is a terrific way of helping me understand Australia's history, understand the way in which our society has evolved. Ever since the beginning, there have always been a small group in the society who has highly disapproved of racing, and that never changes. But on the whole, Australians have a great affinity with, love for horses, and it's amazing, isn't it, how the affection gets going. And I wonder, it seems to be all the female horses these days that really get the emotions going. Winx, of course, is the latest of them, but you think of Black Caviar, Maccabi Diva with her three Melbourne Cups, Sunline. And going back into the history of racing, and perhaps the still arguably the greatest mare ever who raced in Australia, Wakeful, who number of wins has now just been eclipsed by Winx, but Wakeful had the great distinction of winning a Sydney Cup, winning sprint races, and then going to stud, having a foal, and her foal Nightwatch won the 1918 Melbourne Cup. What else hasn't changed about racing, about the Melbourne Cup? Well, it's still a big betting race, and it always had a big prize. £200 added money may not sound a lot these days, but it was a big prize when added to the entry fees of the horses who came into it. So the winning horse ended up earning its owner, Etienne de Mestre, something like £1,000. Which would buy you a fair bit of Melbourne real estate in those days. But also, of course, it was and is still, I have to admit, a big betting race, and the betting has always been part of the story. The bookmakers have been part of the story for forever. The bookmakers were always there from the beginning. They were officially licensed in 1883. They didn't have to worry about competition from the totalisator machine until Farlap was racing, the first tote to arrive in Victoria, we were the last to have it on course, was in the year Farlap was beaten in 1931. And the first TAB, the first off-course betting, was not available until Lord Fury won in 1961. But it's always been a big betting race because the entries are taken a long time ahead, speculation mounts, the weights are given. And these days, with horses coming from overseas, it's a bit like going back to that colonial period. People say, well, how do we know who these horses are? But that was happening in the colonial period. You know, until Archer won the first Melbourne Cup, he'd never been seen to race in Melbourne before. So the race has always attracted that kind of attention. You'll also hear a couple of stories. This year, the club is officially celebrating 25 years since the first, and I've got to get this string of modifiers correct, the first internationally Northern Hemisphere trained horse who came here specially to win the Melbourne Cup, known as Vintage Crop, won the race in 1993. But I get into trouble as a historian because I'm always quibbling over the small detail. Not the first international horse to win the Melbourne Cup, you know, tell that to the New Zealanders. They do believe they're a different country to Australia. So you could argue that Sassanoff, who won the Cup in 1916, was the first international horse to win the race. And you could argue that perhaps the first international to run here was a horse called Panic, who came over here and contested the 1865 Melbourne Cup. He was asked to carry 10 stone. He was a red-hot favourite. He had terrific breeding. It was true that he wasn't going to go on the next ship back to England. He did come over here, became a sire, sired a Melbourne Cup winner, incidentally. But Panic was, as happens in the Melbourne Cup, beaten by an outsider, a little grey pony by the name of Tory Boy, who was trained at South Melbourne. And there used to be a racetrack at Emerald Hill between the high point of South Melbourne and the beach at Port Melbourne, and that's where Tory Boy was trained. There's even been an international horse brought over here specially to win the Melbourne Cup in 1946, brought out here by a very colourful character called Jim Bendroit, who used to write beautiful short stories, romantic short stories about horses and the lure of racing and what it was that got you there. And for him, it was the love of the horse and also the love of the possibility. And he found a horse who'd won the Irish St. Ledger in 1946. He bought him, he put him on a ship, he brought him to Australia. He was brought down to Melbourne, and the horse had the wonderful name of Spam. So before you invented Spam on your mobile phones, it used to be a well-known disgusting meat product in a tin. And this horse was unfortunately called Spam. And Jim Bendroy wrote this wonderful story about Spam. All Spam needed to win the Melbourne Cup in 1946 was a wet track. And, you know, this is Melbourne. Isn't it easy enough to get a wet track in 1946? And, of course, he winds up the story that it's been a dry winter, it's been a dry spring. We get one of those days that we start getting at this time of year where the northerly wind comes in and dries out the track. And, of course, the Melbourne Cup is run in hot conditions in 1946. A horse called Russia wins the race. Spam finishes down the track. They forlornly take the horse back to the stable. And, of course, the dark clouds gather. And before the end of the afternoon, there's a tremendous thunderstorm. So the tears are shed. There are many, many wonderful stories about the Melbourne Cup and about the evolution of it. And I could talk about the evolution of things like the automatic starting barrier, the first trophies, the history of the trophies themselves is a fascinating story in itself. Origins of the photo finish system, first used in 1948, 2 years after Spam, when Rimfire, ridden by the young Ray Neville, a 16-year-old boy, won on Rimfire, beating a hot favourite on a very narrow finish. And all the changes that we've seen as the Melbourne Cup goes, and yet read that 1861 report and you find that the grandstand is full of the fashionable ladies of the time. The governor drives out in his carriage with four matching bays to make an impression, goes down to the mounting yard. I think that that continuity as well as the novelty is part of the story. For me, it's been a great privilege. As a historian, you spend most of the time, as Bruce would know, what I call metaphorically down the mine. You're in the libraries. These days, you might be on the internet doing your research. Round about late September, I suddenly find the phone starts ringing. There it is. Thank you very much. And so the call goes out, you know, Andrew, can you come and tell us about the history of the Melbourne Cup? What do you know about that recent assignment? How long have governors been coming to the Melbourne Cup? When was the first Governor General to present a Melbourne Cup trophy? The answer to that question, I think, is Lord Dudley. Some of you are old enough to remember there used to be a horse called Lord Dudley in the 1970s, but this was the real Lord Dudley, who was the Governor General. Had to present the trophy to the horse who won that year, was properly qualified. His name was Lord Nolan. So I think there are some lovely inner stories within all of these. And you think of the stories within the stories that happen all the time. So since I've been involved with the VRC, one of my great privileges has been to travel with the Melbourne Cup trophy. Now, each year, a new trophy is given out. I understand a few years ago you had the privilege of having the 18-carat gold trophy here at Melbourne Cup Day lunchtime, and it does travel the world. I'm told it's done 70,000 kilometres this year. It's been travelling all around, not only Australia, it went to England, it went to Ireland, it went to Newmarket, it went to the Curragh. It's been doing the rounds, but it also goes to regional areas, country towns, and a chance to share the Melbourne Cup story with people who can't come to Flemington. That's the great joy of it, that you can take it to nursing homes, to hospitals, to schools, to share this story of the Melbourne Cup. And there are people who've seen the Melbourne Cup, and this evening I'll be hosting a viewing of it. If you really want to have a look, you can come down to the State Library this evening where it'll be on display and we'll talk a bit about it. But that opportunity to travel as just part of the team. I do a few days and then others take over. And we take usually a celebrity jockey. I like that bit. It makes me feel very tall. So we meet lovely people like John Marshall, who won on Rogan Josh, and Wayne Harris, who despite having had operations on two brain tumours and many falls. He rode Jeune in 1994, and he's a great ambassador for the sport. And the irrepressible John Letts, who won in 1972 on Piping Lane and 1980 on Belledale Ball, and has never stopped talking since. And John Letts is a very funny man, and I will finish with an example of what a dangerous person he is to travel with. I mean, he knows everybody, particularly in his home state of South Australia. He used to ride the pony after the race and interview the winning jockey. Banjo the pony has since turned up his toes, so John's decided that that's the end of his job there. But He's a lovely but very funny man, and usually the jokes are at other people's expense. So in 2010, when we had the 150th Cup, there was a big reception here at the Sofitel. I remember it at that occasion, the homecoming of the Cup trophy. John said to me, so this was on the Monday night, he said, am I going to see you at the Carbine Club lunch on Friday, the big event that has 900 people coming to it? I said, John, I've got a better offer. I said, Paige Fitzroy, the wife of the chairman, has told me that she's hosting a lunch at Como for the wives of men, the wives who don't want to go to the Carbine Club lunch. And she said, there are 60 of, or 80 of the most intelligent, best-dressed women, and we'd like you to be the MC. So I said, look, John, I've got a better offer, and 60 of or 80 of the best-dressed and most intelligent women, and I'm going to be the only man. And he looked at me 2 seconds and he said, Andrew, there are going to be a lot of disappointed women. So what can you do with that? Part of the fun of the Melbourne Cup, many, many stories. It's a great privilege to be here today, and thank you very much for your reception. Thank you.